so you shot all these in 35. It wasn't like a 16 and then blow up or anything?
No, it was all done on 35. That was the standard at the time. If you wanted to be a contender, you had to use a professional format.
Who were some of your favorite directors to work with? Because you said you worked a lot with Chuck Vincent, but it looks like you even worked with, like, you know, Radley Metzger and a whole lot of other folks.
Yes, I did, Mike, work with most of the directors that were around the New York area, and I would have to say that there were very few that were really, if I were to say my favorite. Now, Armin Weston, who passed away much too young, was one who I worked with, and he was a very skilled director. Some of the directors were not so much directors as just a name position, you know, that they did. And I wish I could remember the name of a guy that I worked with on a film called Alexis or Alexandria. I don't even remember the name of the film, but he was an excellent, he was an old Hollywood director, and he knew his stuff. I learned a lot from him. His first name was Richard, but his last name escapes me. So, you know, there were people around, and there were, you know, if you got the money together, you were, for a film, you were the director.
What was the reaction to Raw Talent when it came out? I mean, this seems like it was such a, you know, you guys were just churning these things out. Did you ever have time to kind of look back with what you just did and see the critical reaction or the public reaction, or did you just move right on to the next one?
Well, while I was doing that film, I remember well, the reason I wasn't cutting that film and was supervising editor was I was shooting another film for Ken. He's got a sister named Barbie from the Mattel fortune. Ken Handler. I was doing a picture for him at the time. Actually, it was the first picture that Melvin Van Peebles was starred in. Not Melvin, Mario.
There we go.
There we are. Great.
Yeah. How's the audio?
Not too bad.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good.
Good.
Yeah, actually, that sounds perfect right there. You've got that nice, nice deeper voice, so that's good.
Okay. Well, while we were waiting, I took off my jockey shorts. That's why.
Oh, okay. The ones that you kept in the freezer all night?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know me too well, Mike.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, after all those Facebook updates and stuff. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were talking about that you knew that this one was going to be different when you were shooting it, or that it was going to be something special.
Yeah, you know, you have a sense, and when you do a script, when you first read a script, you have a sense of whether it's going to be another a run-of-the-mill film or whether it is going to have some substance to it. This was at the time that the films, the feature films, were going into a changeover mode because the theaters were starting to experience couples coming to X-rated films. So there was a big push on a lot of people's parts to get away from the vignette donuts with a wraparound story, seven sex scenes and a wraparound story, and integrate the sex into the film and have it become part of the motivated by the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's funny that you say that since we seem to have gone completely the other way since then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know if you're aware, but, you know, I started in X purely by chance when I went out to get a cup of coffee one morning and I met Bob Wolf, and through a friend who I was doing some legitimate, you know, commercials and stuff, production work. And those were the days. This was 1973. So those were the days that it was 1971. Those were the days of the 8mm loops. And I watched that progression from the loops up to the vignette films and into the Raw Talent and Roommates and In Love and the films that were much better scripts, better quality, better production, better acting, everything, to go completely back around to the loops again. Because about 1985, when people started shooting X stuff on video, it was the curse, because up until that point the scale was going up, you know. But I had people call me and say, "We're doing an X-rated feature on video, but we'll pay you half your salary." You know, it was like a real downward trend, and producers loved it, you know, but I didn't do, I think I did one or two of those films on video, and I didn't like video, and I didn't like people that did, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was when, you know, a lot of, actually video caused a lot of the disparities in film when it became popular to shoot video.
Well, yeah, it must have been such a slap in the face. I mean, you're a technician and an artist combined when you're doing film, and when you're doing video, it just feels like you're a, you know, I don't even want to say camera operator. It just feels like you're, you know, point and shoot kind of stuff.
Well, I had an experience on a film that I did where it was a video, this is, you know, in the mid 80s, and you know, I remember distinctly that there was a scene with a bar, and there were mirrors on the bar, and the engineer was going crazy. You know, he was saying it's peaking and the, you know, it's blowing out in the whites and the highlights and stuff, because the problem with video was it had very little latitude. You couldn't, you know, on film, you could have somebody walk in front of a window and the window wouldn't blow out, but on video. And so everything became the bailiwick of the engineers. And so I said, well, you know, what do you suggest we do here? And he said, well, I think you ought to get like a big black sheet and just cover the whole thing up. that was his solution. Never, you know, in total honesty, he said that, thinking, you know, he was looking, you know, and he was the same guy that said to me at one point, he says, geez, I don't know how you could shoot a film looking at it through the eyepiece. He says, I look at the oscilloscope. That's what tells me what... You know, how can you do that? You know?
Wow.
But 35, as we know, was very forgiving and had a large latitude. So, and then the original video editing was the stupidest thing that ever happened. I mean, it was, I stayed away from that one, because if you wanted, you know, when the digital came in, they touted it as being nonlinear. That what that was referring to was, in the video editing, first you had to run the tape and black the tape. You had to run the tape for the hour and a half or whatever it was and make it black. Right. And then if you wanted to insert a shot between two shots, you had to take it to the first shot, dump everything onto another video, and then insert your shot, and then... go back and dub the rest of the scene in. So every time you did that, it was just hideous. And the quality got worse and worse and worse in the editing. I mean, in film, you would rip the film, or you would get dirt, or you would get scratches, but you never worried about that. and the video, you know, at the end of editing, some of the stuff I saw other people doing, it was like you could barely discern what was on the screen. They had duped it so many times, and every generation, because that was analog, it lost some of the details. So it was a horrible, horrible experience, you know, the video thing. And it wasn't until this digital age that we live in now, thank goodness, came around that I, you know, my last film that I on 35 was about 4 years ago, and I was still using the same camera that I shot Raw Talent with.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah, because, you know, it's a 35-millimeter Aeroflex camera with all the bells and whistles and zooms and Zeiss and all the stuff that goes with it. And, you know, the guys that bought that bought all the video stuff in 1985, you know, by 1990, they were crying the blues because Sony had, you know, all of a sudden everything had to be Beta SP. They put out a fortune. As a matter of fact, the guy that sold me my BL, he saw me about 10 years later. I was shooting an IBM commercial, and he said, "You son of a bitch," he said, "you're still getting $500 a day rental on that camera, and I've put up millions of dollars into these trucks, these mobile things and stuff." And he said, they're all obsolete, because that's what Sony knew from, he learned from Detroit. It's like you've got the technology, but you don't release it all at once. You let it go for about 5 years, and then everybody's got to retool.
Right.
So That's you know, I did a film in South America with that same camera about 4 years ago.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that Don't Go to Strangers?
Don't Go to Strangers was Nate Osborne's film, and we actually, he just got that on. We did that basically back in the early 90s. No, it was a film called Rainbow Ronnie.
Oh, okay.
Which was a Bollywood film.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Well, the third world countries, India and South Africa and stuff, they still have 35 theaters that, you know, have the reel-to-reel changeovers and, you know, wooden benches. So there's still a market for that stuff. But, you know, when the digital came in, I was one of the first people to order a RED camera, you know. Mm-hmm. Serial number 1201 or something. So
yeah. Was that shot in English, or was it shot in Telugu or another Indian language?
No, it was shot in English, and it had some New York people. We did it in Guyana, which is, we all remember Jim Jones, Guyana.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We did it in Guyana. Guyana is the only English-speaking country in South America, so we did it there, and it is a very high percentage. It's about 60% of our Indians there. They're all the merchants who own the country, pretty much.
Huh. You know? I did not know that.
Well, it's one of those places that you don't see much about, but it's critical geographically for the United States, and they keep a strong presence there because it's just below Venezuela. It's at the back door of Brazil. And so because it's English speaking, there is an American presence there, but it's a very, there's only like something like 790,000 people. There's less than a million people live in the whole country, and they all live in Georgetown. But it's a it's a real godforsaken place, let me tell you. We had to wrap that film up because the Minister of Agriculture and his whole family were assassinated in the last week. We were supposed to be shooting all the night stuff, and we were afraid of martial law, you know, coming down. But that was not unusual for people to get shot. All the crew, all the people, all the stars, they all had bodyguards, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's another, that's part of the second book. I'm just finishing the first book now.
Yeah. So are you really writing a book?
Yes, I've been working on it for about 4 years, Mike. So,
that's great.
Yeah, yeah. So the first, I wrote the whole arc of my experiences in motion pictures. And, the story editor said, look, you can go back and take the 70s and do a whole book on that. Why don't you do that? Which is what I did, because I was affiliated and associated with people that I had no idea. Richard Kuklinski, the Iceman. I don't know if you saw that HBO series. Roy DeMeo, the book on him was called Murder Machine. Eddie Dahls, Eddie Mishkin, all these people back in the 70s when the X-rated films were illegal until 1977, when the Supreme Court put the ball back into the local courts, excuse the pun. And then the businessmen came in, and it became a business because all of the jurisdictions were local. There was no federal jurisdiction at that point. And before then, federally, it was a felony, and locally, it was a misdemeanor. So that period was a very interesting period. And the Triple X film started in 60. The first one was about 69. And by 77, it had run the course, and it was, it was considered quasi-legal, depending on who was in office at the time. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I was talking to one filmmaker who had, he made a film shortly after Deep Throat and was just kind of made it in New Jersey, all, his friends and relatives and family, shot some of it in the, it was like the Bishop of wherever in New Jersey this was. They shot some of the stuff in his house.
Right.
And they were just like, oh yeah, la, 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 la. And really didn't have any problems in New Jersey. It wasn't until the film played in Kansas City when the feds came in. They're like, oh, cross state lines.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That was the whole trial in Tennessee of Deep Throat was because they flew it by plane to Florida. Did it cross state lines?
That's crazy.
Well, it all hinged. That was when Nixon was going through a lot of headaches with Watergate and Vietnam and all of his, he and B.B. Rebozo were up there, making hypocrites of themselves.
Right.
But that was politically motivated, and then when Reagan got in, it was the same thing again with the Mies Commission. And then they were, even until 2001, when George W. got back into office there, they were starting to rev up again. Because during the Clinton years, they kind of green lighted everything. They put the money into, substantial problems in the legal system, instead of this. But it's always been the ploy to take the onus away from some political thing, and make it into a moralistic thing, because people responded more to that. And because like Times Square and the sex shops and stuff were such a high profile, people could identify with that. They didn't know during Iran-Contra scandal with Reagan, what was going on. Nobody knew what was going on, but they could see the Village Voice running salacious ads and the porn shops in Times Square and stuff. So the politicians have always done that. They've always, the whole thing with Deep Throat was because Lindsay, who was trying to get reelected, he was the incumbent mayor at the time. And, that was one of his big political public moves to try to clean up Times Square, you know? Uh-huh. And Deep Throat would have not been anything more than just another average film had it not had all the illegal attention, you know?
Right. Yeah, because looking back on it now, it's like, this really isn't that good of a movie.
Well, you know, I had to, one of the friends of Italian opera came with a print, a 16-millimeter print of it, and he says, Larry, I want you to cut this into, a four-box version that can be sold in 8-millimeter. And I had to shoot, because eight millimeter didn't have sound, I had to reduce the Deep Throat story to cards like the old movies where it took 8 cards with all the nuances. No, that was the wild card, that film, and it was just because of the legal, you know, all of the, and the fact that the press jumped on it, that it became the iconic film from that period.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right. And then you got to do the sequel too, right?
I did. I directed a sequel in about 1985, I think it was, and we shot it out in Corona, Queens at the Adventure Studio, which is an infamous studio. A lot of stuff, actually a lot of raw talent was shot there. Jerry Damiano was living upstairs when I did Deep Throat 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know at the time that I was doing it for Butchie Pirano. I was doing it under the auspices of a company called Big Apple. Butchie was there a couple of times, but his name was, he had already been found guilty on my porn charges and was waiting sentencings. And one of the stipulations was that he couldn't be involved in X-Rated. So I didn't know who this guy Gabe, he was introduced and went by the name of Gabe, but it was Butchie Pirano,
very cool.
Pirano. I shot Deep Throat 2. And there's another example of, you know, going the extra, the scene where she talks to herself. I don't know if you've ever seen the film, but there's a scene where the woman that's playing the lead talks to supposedly her mother in the mirror. And she's actually talking to herself. So that had to be done. You know, I did the opticals on that myself, bypacked that and did it, you know, and unfortunately you see a little matte line around it. But at the time it was, you know, it was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So I always liked doing all that stuff, you know.
So I should probably get back to raw talent while we're talking. Do you have any other memories about the shooting of that? I mean, how was the atmosphere on set? Well, I was very curious I'm peppering you now with questions.
That's all right.
I was very curious how it was working with Lisa DeLue.
Oh, Lisa was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And she had a great sense of humor. What you saw on the screen was what you got with her. And she had a great demeanor working. And you know, the scene where Jerry shoves her head in the toilet after she has belittled, blackmailed him and berated him in every way possible. And when he's finally fed up, he shoves her head in the toilet. And for that scene, the scene called for him doing that. And then she runs out. Well, she had to run out. And she had to run down this hall and she had to get on an elevator. And we were in a building, and she's naked. So she runs out, the elevator opens, we had a PA, you think, but nobody took the precaution of making sure that the elevator would stay there. So the super of the building and the plumber got on the first floor. Here's Lisa DeLue, buck naked, standing in the elevator, you know, so... they that was a ride they will not forget anytime soon.
I wouldn't think so.
But she was terrific. They were all terrific. I can't think of anybody that I mean, I wished I could. I would make it interesting. But you know, Jerry was great to work with. He always was prepared. Jerry was always prepared. And the same thing with Lisa. You know, Rhonda Jo Petty had a very insignificant role in that. But Joey Savar, they all knew their stuff. They knew what, you know, they had the script. They knew it was coming. And there wasn't a whole lot of, I mean, as I said before, those films were done on a 5-day budget. So it was, there wasn't a whole lot of wiggle room for any kind of nonsense, except for that first day when Jerry and Joyce didn't show up, you know. But that was, it makes a good topic, you know.
So you said you had 5 days to shoot it, but how long do you get in post for a movie like that?
Probably about, an average on a film like that would be about 90 days, 6 weeks.
Okay.
To 90 days, because it was cut in film. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, that was done, you know, while I was shooting with Ken Handler. The film, the name of that film was Delivery Boys. When I was shooting that, I would come in at night, and Paul, who was the assistant editor and doing all the stuff, he would show me what they had done during the day and so forth. And then we would go on for there. And I remember being very impressed with Paul. He's the one that he actually wound up directing the second the sequel of Raw Talent. And that came a bit of a shock to me. But, you know, I had usurped Ron Sullivan by doing the film in the first place. And now my editor is going to direct the third film. But it's okay. I mean, it's all fair games and stuff. And Joyce wrote me a note. She said, Larry, you know, I apologize. She said, I'm going to use Paul to direct the sequel because he's cheap. And I wrote her back a note, and I said, Paul's not cheap. You are. You know? because she was, you know, that was a typical kind of situation where somebody, you know, they got a good thing going and they, you know, they try to fix it. It ain't broken. They try to fix it, you know?
Right.
So, 6 weeks on something like that. And then then it was a question of the mixing and then having the prints struck, you know, at, the lab and so forth. So, I would say 90 days, 3 months probably.
So you just mentioned that you had usurped Ron Swanson. I'm sorry, I missed the name.
Ron Sullivan.
Sullivan. How
Andre Bouchard.
Oh, okay.
Well, as I said earlier, Ron and Joyce, Ron had done public affairs with Joyce, and Joyce had talked to Ron about doing it and about doing Raw Talent. But Ron wanted points. He wanted to change the script around and stuff, you know. And you see, Ron liked to fiddle with the script. And I preferred to take the script if I accepted it and, you know, make minor changes, but no drastic changes, basically because I didn't want it coming back to me if the film was a flop saying, you changed the script. You know,
right.
But yep. When in fact, you know, if I held to the, and I remember afterwards, you know, talking to Joyce, and I said, you know, Joyce said, well, I'm going to have another film, you know, can you direct it? I said, Joyce, I can direct a phone book if you give it to me. And she said, well, you might have to. So, you know, the directing chores, I mean, a lot of people the director is like this mysterious character that sort of brings the whole thing together, which a director does, but usually it's the matter of money. In my particular case, I always prefer to get people that were talented, and just like the makeup lady brings her kit to set, the talent brings their talent to set. Mm-hmm. So other than things that were blatantly wrong or nuances that you wanted to finesse, the job of directing was really being the receptacle as the audience by proxy in a way, and just being quick enough to say, okay, there's something wrong here. What is it? Let's try to fix it. You know, that type of thing. So a lot of people don't understand that. They think that the director tells the actors what their motivation is. And, you know, it was always the motivation was your paycheck, you know?
Right.
So that's how that worked.
Well, very cool. I was going to say, it's funny that Delivery Boys, it just sounds like such a porn title.
I know it. And Ken Handler, you know, that was the biggest mistake. Poor thing. You know, he died of AIDS in the 90s, I think. But he was, he had all the money in the world. I mean, he was literally, the Ken doll was named after him. And his sister Barbie was the Barbie doll. And he was the heir to the Mattel fortune. And he had the money to do that film. And as it turned out, there was a lot of trouble because he was SAG, because it was a SAG film. And he was essentially doing the film because he liked Puerto Rican boys. You know? And so that was... we had a lot of grief from SAG. And I remember we shot the breakdance scenes under the Brooklyn Bridge. And we shot it, and he didn't like it. And we did it again with 3 busload of SAG extras. You know, now that, that's out of pocket for him.
Right.
You know, which is substantial, you know.
Oh, yeah.
With all of the SAG rules and stuff. So, yeah, it sounded like an X-rated film. And he actually did that film through Chuck Vincent's studio. That was, you know, some people would come to Chuck and they would just hire his staff and crew to do a film. And that's what Ken Handler did.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, I think I'm pretty well good for this. It has been a real pleasure talking to you. It's been
Likewise. Likewise, it's been my pleasure recounting all these old memories.
I'm in the process of tracking down another one that you shot. Bordello, House of the Rising Sun.
Right, that was a Chuck Vincent film, and that was one of the films that was actually probably a 3-day shoot. That was not a major film at all. And we did that again at Adventure Studios.
It's years and years ago, I went to the UK just like right out of college or right out of high school going into college. And I was like determined to – I had gone there once before and had gone to Soho and hung out and really enjoyed it. And the next time I went, I was determined to go to one of their adult theaters. And I'm pretty sure that what I saw at the adult theater, which would have been 5-6 years old at the time, was Bordello.
Ah.
But what I saw was no sex scenes. They had cut all the sex out. It was an adult theater showing basically softcore or R-rated
kind of stuff. Only the English.
I know. And I've been trying to figure out what movie I saw because it was so long ago. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure it was a whorehouse, and I'm pretty sure Jerry Butler was in it. And so when I saw his, you know, was going through his filmography, I'm like, okay, I think it was this Bordello film. So,
okay. Could well have been. And we used the famous House of the Rising Sun music for that.
Nice.
That was the original work title on that film, was House of the Rising Sun.
Oh, and then you had to throw Bordello in there just so folks knew.
Well, you know, I think there was probably some copyright problems involved in that. I don't really know, because that was in Chuck Vincent's bailiwick, all of that stuff. But I do remember that that was during a period that we were, you know, we did three or four of those. We did another one that was based on the Goldie Hawn film, G.I. Jane, or whatever it was that she was in.
Private Benjamin was hers, yeah.
Oh, so yeah. that was our title, G.I. Jane.
Oh, that's funny. And then they used that for that Demi Moore movie years later.
Yes, maybe that's what, I don't know. You know, these are, like I said, it's 3 days out of your life, you know.
Right, right.
And shooting at adventure was always like really kind of down and dirty. Get it, you know, it's like, you know, Chuck was great. You never went over 10 hours because he had it down to a science, you know. So, you know, we do those films in 3 days. And so some of them, you know, are a little blurred, fuzzy around the edges, you know.
I imagine. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm amazed that you have such vivid memories of Raw Talent, it being a 10-day shoot. But I guess the 90 days post kind of helps that. You still there?
Yeah. Well, any film that I directed, that I had to, you know, I took it very seriously and put a lot of pre-production, production and post-production into those films. So, you know, I mean, your name is your only thing you've got going for you. So, you know, I was determined to get the most mileage out of the money for a film as possible, you know?
Right.
So... Do you know Steve at DistroPix?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, Steve would be somebody interesting. He took over his father. Steve Marowitz took over from his father, Artie Marowitz, and they had they bought Sam Lake's Mature Pictures. So there's a whole he's remastering and. He just did Naked Came a Stranger and another film.
Oh, okay.
He remastered that, and he might be somebody that, you know, would be interesting. What's his name in Chicago there, you know, they would be good too.
Right.
For more material. I'm sure you're always looking for different Lee Jones. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's on Facebook, so.
I just talked to Radley Metzger, and he was talking about that, Naked Came a Stranger, that it was, he was really glad that that's out on DVD now.
Yes, yes. Oh, and that, you know, that the story behind that film made from the book is just hilarious. It's just a riot, you know, what that whole thing was. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was one of the biggest hoaxes put over on the American public. You know, they had 23 staff writers at Newsday, each wrote a chapter.
Uh-huh.
And Mike McGrady, who was the editor at Newsday at the time, put it together in a book because the Valley of the Dolls had come out, and he thought, boy, if Jacqueline Suzanne can sell a book like this, I'm going to, you know, and he did. Radley bought it, and... So these are all links that I'm, you know, connecting in the book, in my book also. So,
which I can't wait to read. It sounds like it's going to be fascinating.
Well, yeah, I'm just at the point now where I'm starting to approach to get an agent. So I'll get an agent, and if I have success, I'll let you know.
Well, that's great. Yeah, terrific. Yeah, definitely keep me posted on that. I would love to read it.
Yeah, well, I would. You and a 999,000 more.
Yeah.
So that is. We'll see. Stranger things have happened, right?
Right. Yeah.